Welcome, everybody, and thank you for joining us today for our REAMP webinar titled The Road Ahead for Electric Vehicle Policy in the Midwest. My name is Eric Bosted, and I am the REAMP Commons Coordinator. And today I have with me John Bailey from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And John is a senior policy researcher at ILSR. He has been with ILSR since 1992 and is the author of reports across a range of topics, including local road financing in Minneapolis, wind energy taxation, ecological tax reform, and climate change policy. He's ILSR's webrarian, and in 2005, he spearheaded the legislative effort that led to a new state law directing the Minnesota Department of Commerce and Public Utilities Commission to set up an e-filing system to enhance public participation in energy and telecommunications-related regulatory proceedings and to save taxpayer money. He also served for over 2 years on a state-level working group that designed the interconnection rules and tariffs for clean, small-scale, distributed generation projects in Minnesota. And just a little background on today's webinar. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance was tapped in 2009 by REAMP to do a scoping report on electric vehicles to inform the network on what role they might play in the REAMP region. Today's webinar will provide an overview of ILSR's findings and recommendations. And just a technical note, throughout the webinar, if you have any questions, you can type them into the chat box in the bottom left-hand side of your screen. And we will be holding all topical questions until the end. The webinar or the presentation will run for 30 to 40 minutes, and then the rest of the time will be held for question and answer, in which I will give instructions for how to unmute your line and jump into the discussion for voice questions, or at that time you can also type in questions in the chat box as well. And I would also like to welcome, we have some guests from outside of the REAMP network, so welcome to everyone from REAMP and from outside the network. And with that, I will turn it over to John to jump into his presentation.
Thanks, Eric, and thanks to all of you for joining the call. The presentation today is based on a report that we did that was funded by REAMP, the Global Warming Strategic Action Fund, and the ultimate goal was whether or not it made sense for REAMP organizations and funders to be focusing on electric vehicle issues and to identify how best we can get greenhouse gas reductions from EVs. And our report was published in late December, and the link to that was sent around. So people should have that. And here's the outline of what we'll do today, just give a little brief history of electric vehicles around the country, and then look at more specifically at what's going on in the REAMP states, and then jump into the greenhouse gas implications of EVs, and maybe do the economic issues, maybe not, depending on time, and then jump into the policy options that we surveyed, and then finish off with the 8 points that we recommend REAMP work on it in the near term. So with that, before we start, I had a couple of things to keep in mind. In the next 10 years, EVs will have a very small impact on reducing emissions in the REAMP states. But having said that, EVs are tightly linked with other important policies and objectives that still make them an important technology to promote. And these include low-carbon fuel standards, renewable energy expansion, smart grid developments, and fuel efficiency standards or CAFE standards. EV expansion will enhance our energy security over time, and it will increase the efficiency of our vehicles, and hopefully it will create a new industrial platform in the country. And one other thing I should note is that you'll hear me use a lot in this presentation, and I'm using that term to encompass vehicles that are plugged into the grid for recharging, and those could be plug-in hybrid vehicles or pure electric vehicles, battery electric vehicles. So to the history, recent history, from about 1990 to 2000, we used in the report a metaphor of the tide coming in and out. And during the 90s to 2000, the EV tide definitely came in. It catalyzed by marketplace and policy developments. And then from 2000 to 2005, the EV tide went out, largely a result of opposition from the U.S. auto industry. And from 2005 to 2007, the tide began to rise again, and spurred this time by grassroots initiatives and rising oil prices. And finally, since 2008, we're calling it a EV tsunami out there, the kind of unprecedented economic and political forces and news and developments and increasingly rapid technological initiatives. And it looks like EVs have staying power this time around. So going back to 1990, a lot of this all started back in California when the California Air Resources Board began its zero-emission vehicles regulations. And they had a goal of having 2% of the vehicles for sale in California by 1998 and 10% of vehicles by 2003 be all electrics. It didn't quite work out, but by 1998, there were about 5,000 EVs on the road in California. By the end of the 90s, progress on EVs had begun to stall. The automakers were pressuring California to eliminate some of its requirements for EVs. But we also see in 1999 Honda introducing the first hybrid electric vehicle in the U.S., the Honda Insight. Moving to the 2000 to 2005 time frame, we see the automakers and the Bush administration suing California and the California Air Resources Board, and all but abandoning its electric vehicle mandate. Gas prices were extremely low. SUVs began their surge in the marketplace. And made famous in the film Who Killed the Electric Car, in 2003, GM decided not to renew leases on its fleet of EV1 vehicles and instead would reclaim them in 2004. The EV tide had clearly started to go out at this point. Moving the grassroots efforts in to stop car companies from crushing the EVs in California was the start of the EV tide coming back in. Hundreds of EVs survived and became the foundation for building new support for the technology. By 2005, several Prius hybrids had been converted into plug-ins. And led by Felix Kramer at the organization CalCars, policymakers were being targeted to start a new EV revolution. Oil prices began to rise from about $25 a barrel in 2003 to $90 in 2007. Hybrid vehicles sales were surging, and Toyota ended up abandoning its tagline, "You never have to plug it in," when it announced it would lease a fleet of Prius plug-in vehicles in Japan beginning in 2010. So the tsunami starts around 2008. Oil is at $140 a barrel. There's a new focus on efficiency. Obama's elected with a campaign pledge to make energy security a key issue. The bailout of the auto companies are tied to greener vehicles. Billions of dollars as part of the economic stimulus packages are targeting smart grids, efficiency, renewables, domestic batteries, green retooling in the automotive industry. And there were major projects funded involving charging, EVs charging infrastructure and test vehicles in cities around the country. The federal CAFE standards proposed by the Obama administration will bring the biggest boost to fuel economy in decades and also help EVs. Countries around the world begin vying for leadership in electric vehicles and battery development. The federal government is now giving $7,500 incentive for purchasing EVs beginning this month. 200,000 vehicles per manufacturer will qualify for that. Waiting lists for cars have begun. Conversions of hybrid vehicles to plug-ins is being funded by the federal government up to 10% of the cost of conversions. BYD Auto, Chrysler, Fisker, Ford, GM, Nissan, Mitsubishi, Tesla and Think have announced EVs or plug-in hybrid vehicles for the American market in 2010 and 2011. Obama himself has called for a million plug-ins to be on the road by 2015, and the manufacturers we talked to preparing our report said that it's an aggressive undertaking, but that they were ready to try to make it happen. So I think it's clear that we've reached kind of new heights in the electric vehicle history, and the world appears to be on a path to replace the internal combustion engine and move towards electricity. With that as the historical backdrop, we can move to what's going on already in the REAMP states on this issue. And just first, I'll mention that the National Conference of State Legislatures said that there were 68 pieces of legislation in 25 states last year that involved electric vehicles. About a dozen of those were enacted, and this compares to nearly 800 bills related to energy efficiency and more than 2,000 related to renewables. Among the new laws in Hawaii and Minnesota and Washington, we see some legislation related to developing the infrastructure for plug-in electric vehicles. Colorado has created a EV grant fund that provides grants to local governments to install charging stations. Oregon changed an existing tax credit, $1,500 tax credit for purchasing hybrids, to that it now only covers plug-in vehicles. In general, in REAMP, there's not a great deal going on yet with respect to EV policy in most of the states. Minnesota has done an EV impact study and completed a study recently on how gas taxes might be replaced as more and more EVs enter the fleet. Minnesota also has a purchasing preference for state vehicles, but it's not very effective. I think probably the state with the clear winning record so far in the REAMP region has been the state of Michigan, and it's probably not all that surprising, but Michigan's governor has made EVs and advanced battery manufacturing a high priority. And so we can look at EV in a little bit more detail. Despite their budget shortfalls, like in most of the REAMP states, Michigan has managed to throw approximately $1 billion in state money to attract EV and advanced battery manufacturing to the state. And the state has aggressively pursued the federal stimulus monies. There's a property tax exemption in Michigan for high-tech businesses that include battery research and development firms. In Michigan, they're also doing research. There's a $5 million multi-year study going on via the University of Michigan to study the impacts of EVs in the state from a variety of perspectives, both environmental and economic. They have a smart grid collaborative process in place that is examining EVs and the various vehicle to grid issues. The governor in August announced a Michigan Academy for Green Mobility, a college level training program for advanced vehicle engineering. So there's quite a bit going on in Michigan, and they are seeing results of their efforts. Just briefly, Ford is planning on building its EV Focus in Michigan, saying it's 3,200 jobs there. Daimler is using a tax break to advance electric drive propulsion systems. A variety of companies, Johnson Controls, LG Chem, A123 Systems, are using state tax breaks, stimulus money, and investing more than $1.5 billion to launch advanced battery plants, 6,700 jobs there. Michigan projects got over half of the $2.5 billion in the economic stimulus package for advanced vehicles and advanced battery manufacturing. So they're clearly out in front, and we can look to them for guidance on how other states might adopt or structure their incentive policies, but they are kind of uniquely situated with their existing infrastructure for the automobile industry. Moving now to the question of greenhouse gases and whether EVs can have an impact on reducing them. As this chart shows, I hope you can see it, the transportation emissions in the REAMP states range from about 12 to 31% as a percent of total emissions, with most states in the 20 to 30% range. So reducing emissions from transportation is clearly needed if we're going to reach our long-term goals of 80% reductions by 2050. As part of the scope of the work, on this project, we said we'd try to compare EV expansion with other policies to reduce emissions from the transportation sector. And so we looked at CAFE, low carbon fuel standard, and vehicle miles traveled reductions as the comparison. So the federal fuel efficiency standards proposed by the Obama administration are, well, they're critically important for increasing the efficiency and pushing technological development of the automotive industry. It's certain that we should continue efforts to strengthen them in the future. The new proposed standards will have final rules coming soon in 2010. For the first time, there will be an emissions standard along with the usual miles per gallon standard. By 2016, for cars and light trucks, the fleet-wide standard will be 34.1 miles per gallon, and the fleet-wide emission standard will be 250 grams of CO2 per mile. And without getting too lost in the complexity of the standards, in meeting the miles per gallon standard, the car manufacturers will have an incentive to sell electric vehicles, since these vehicles will likely get very high miles per gallon ratings. GM and its Chevy Volt, that's coming out later this year, has said that they will get a 230 mile per gallon rating, and Nissan, who's coming out with their electric vehicle, the Leaf, has said that they will get about a 367 mile per gallon rating. So selling those cars can potentially generate credits for the automakers that can be used in a limited way to meet the CAFE requirements in vehicle classes that they might have a fleet rating that's a little below what they need to be. On the greenhouse gas emissions standard portion of CAFE, it's been proposed, and it's a little controversial, that each electric vehicle in a car maker's fleet gets to count as two vehicles, each of which are deemed as getting a 0 grams per mile rating. And despite this, the fact that the electricity used to charge the vehicle will have greenhouse gas emissions associated with it. The two-for-one incentive is proposed to end with the 2016 model year, so it won't apply to probably more than a million vehicles. So in the end, we did a very rough calculation based on making some assumptions, and we see that the CAFE standards will lead to about a 5 to 9% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector emissions by 2020 compared to the 2005 levels. Next, we looked at the potential impacts of the low-carbon fuel standard in the Midwest. That's a 10% reduction requirement in the carbon intensity of transportation fuels by it's envisioned by 2020. The nice thing about it is that the LCFS is that it applies to fuels that go into existing and new vehicles, where the CAFE standard, for example, only applied to new vehicles. Since the LCFS probably won't get to all the fuels generating emissions in the transportation sector, we estimated that there would be about a 8.5% real reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from the policy by 2020, and that's if the policy were in place today. The bad news is that no low-carbon fuel standard policy yet exists in the REAMP states. The potential impact of the policy by 2020 gets less and less as the years go by. But Many groups are working on this in their respective states, and so for the report, we took some time to look at the implications for electric vehicles under such a policy. And to do this, we looked to California, where a low-carbon fuel standard is moving ahead, although I have heard that the ethanol industry has sued to stop the policy from going into effect, although I didn't verify that. I heard about it. So in looking at California's proposed regulations, which would probably be similar to anything that's in the Midwest, we see that EVs, if you can read this table, the middle column is the percentage reduction from the standard baseline gasoline. So to meet the standard in 2020, you'd have to have a minus 10 in that column. And so we see that EVs are, towards the bottom, are the electric vehicles that are one of the most favorable pathways for meeting the California standard. And the pathways for biofuels that have been approved so far in California don't even come close to the type of emission reduction that electric vehicles can give. 100% EV in California, using average electricity out there, will have 57% less carbon than the baseline gasoline. I will mention, though, that the pathways for cellulosic ethanol technologies have not been yet completed out there. So it's probably easier to read this particular graphic offline. I guess it's coming out pretty clear, but I just tried to put together a little summary picture of total emissions in the REAMP states, transportation emissions, and then the estimated reductions in year 2020 from CAFE and the low-carbon fuel standard. Region-wide, we estimated that the two policies would combine to reduce transportation sector emissions by about 15.5% by 2020. But that assumes that the low-carbon fuel standard is in place right now. The next thing we looked at was the issue of reducing vehicle miles traveled. The chart on this slide just shows the trends in VMT in the REAMP states from 1997 to 2007. It looks pretty stable for the most part, or growing slowly. As VMT advocates know, though, the high gas prices before the economic collapse appeared to be having an impact on driving, and VMT looked to be trending down if we look beyond 2007. Gas prices are, in the future, are a bit of a wild card, I think, in terms of how the trends in VMT continue. More generally, we found that strategies to reduce VMT require a longer-term effort. Changing land use laws, for example, or scaling up transit or expanding rail networks in order to see results. So clearly there are going to be greenhouse gas benefits from these investments and policy changes. And the important takeaway, I think, is that the implementation needs to begin now, since the payoff is years down the road. And the longer we wait, the longer those benefits are stretched out. There was a recent report by the Urban Land Institute called Moving Cooler, and it concluded that by 2050, actions leading to VMT reductions could lead to about a 9 to 15% reduction in transportation emissions, with most of those occurring after 2020 or 2030. So now we turn to the potential for EVs to reduce emissions in REAMP, and I've already mentioned that their impact is going to be quite small. But to make the calculation, you have to consider two factors, the greenhouse gas impact of the individual vehicle, which is the electricity that's being supplied for primarily, and the amount of fuel it continues to use if it's a plug-in hybrid. And then the other factor is the speed at which EVs enter and replace the current fleet of vehicles in the market. So with regard to the impact of individual vehicles, there have been dozens of studies, and the vast majority find that plug-in hybrids and EVs will reduce emissions compared to traditional vehicles. Most studies have found that EVs release 25 to 65% less carbon. Most of the studies so far are focused on national level electricity mixes, but more and more studies are looking at regions, states, and even looking at impacts down at the neighborhood level. The good news is that even a vehicle powered by 100% coal can generate the same or less emissions than a comparable conventional vehicle. The Midwest, of course, has, as we probably all know, has a much more carbon-intensive electricity sector than the nation on average. The Midwest relies on coal to generate about 73% of its electricity, compared to 51% for the nation. The chart on this slide shows the percentage of coal in each REAMP state. Obviously, states with shorter bars in general will have cleaner EVs out of the gate than states with more reliance on coal. And I guess we say go South Dakota. According to this chart, they have the lowest reliance on coal. We certainly don't want a world where it's just a little bit cleaner than normal vehicles. So our future work, I think, must continue full steam ahead to make the bars in this chart disappear. The continued efforts to expand renewable energy in the region, therefore, are top priority still for the REAMP network. EVs are the perfect technology for storing variable renewable resources, and we'll need to continue to develop policy that drives renewable energy into our vehicles' battery packs. A note that output from about 500 utility-scale wind turbines can generate enough electricity for fueling 1 million electric vehicles. And I was delighted to find that one of our generation and transmission cooperatives in Minnesota has a pilot EV charging program that touts the ability of participants to store power of the wind in their cars. There have been some environmental and economic impact studies done in the REAMP states already, and there are currently major studies ongoing in Ohio, Michigan, and Illinois. In Minnesota in 2007, there's an impact study that found that in a 60% coal, 40% wind nuclear scenario, hybrid electrics, plug-in hybrids, and full EVs all resulted in emission reductions compared to conventional vehicles. And an initial study in Illinois by the Argonne National Lab added a little wrinkle to the mix when a model showed that many EVs in Illinois would be clustered in the Chicago area, and in some cases, particular neighborhoods of Chicago, with the possibility that some distribution-level substations could feel the strain of EVs being charged. Argonne is doing a lot more detailed work, and that should be coming out fairly soon. Simply knowing the average electricity mix in your state isn't quite detailed enough if we want to ensure that EVs are as clean as possible. The timing of charging up vehicles must be compared to the timing of power plants supplying the electricity to the grid as well. And most utilities want EV charging to occur at off-peak times, and they're very concerned about this. They don't want their system to be overloaded, and this makes perfect sense from an efficiency perspective. Charging rates can be lowered for consumers, and existing power plants and distribution and transmission lines can meet the needs of EV charging for years to come without needing to do much infrastructure work. But from a greenhouse gas reduction perspective, we would want to charge a vehicle when emissions from electricity productions are lowest. The chart on this slide is from Xcel Energy's Colorado territory, and it shows that charging EVs at off-peak times might be worse because there's more coal-fired power than simply letting people charge throughout the day and night. The time of year will also show some variations in what power is being supplied to the grid, so It may be that in Iowa in the summer, we want EV charging to occur at off-peak times, but in winter, we would want daytime charging to occur. All of this simply points to the kind of a critical information hole that we need to get filled in more completely in the near term, so that by the time that EVs start to enter the market in significant numbers, we can have the policy in place that results in truly green EVs rather than something more brownish. So that brings us to the question of how fast will EVs enter the market? And with rapidly changing developments in public policy, energy storage technologies, and EV manufacturing, it's difficult to make any precise estimates, I think. But most estimates by outsiders and political leaders and the industry itself kind of cluster around a projection of a million EVs on the road in the 2015-2017 timeframe, with a rapid expansion to 3 million nationwide by 2020 and 16 million by 2030. If we use the 3 million figure in 2020 and assume that a fifth of those are in the reamp states, that's 600,000 vehicles, and make some further assumptions on how much emissions reductions might come from each vehicle compared to an existing vehicle, we found that there'd be an overall transportation sector emissions reduction of about 0.25% from EVs entering the market. It's a small number to be sure in the short term. So that's the greenhouse gas reduction discussion. We see in the end that CAFE standard and low carbon fuel standards have more immediate impact than EV or VMT strategies, reduction strategies. But each of the options, I think, have long-term positive implications, and EVs in particular are keenly connected to the success of those other policies. So I guess I don't know if I should do this economic discussion. I think I'm just going to say very briefly that EVs are more expensive, and it's probably no surprise if you follow the news. And this is primarily due to the high cost of batteries, and we have to add in the cost of charging systems if you want to charge the vehicles in kind of a faster way, known as level 2 charging, 3 to 5 hours. That's going to add another $2,000 to the homeowner. A lot of these costs are being made up from, at the moment, from tax incentives, and there will be lower vehicle operating costs and maintenance costs over time. And if we see a world where higher gas prices come into being again, that will improve the economics as well. So I'm just going to leave that. If you want more discussion on some of the issues of economics, batteries, and EV charging, and fuel costs, I would suggest you take a look at our report. So let's move to the policies discussion. We surveyed a host of policies around the country. There are hundreds of ideas out there, but we tried to focus mainly on state-level ideas, since that matched more closely with most of the REAMP group's focus. There will be a lot of work, I think, that needs to be done at the local level in terms of policy, so there should be some focus on that in the future. We broke out our discussion by three areas: enhancing consumer acceptance policies to promote EV infrastructure and integration, and then expanding EV and related manufacturing. So on the consumer side, it was mainly a lot of ideas about how we can throw a lot more money at consumers to make these vehicles more attractive for them to purchase. It's hard for me to imagine in the REAMP states, with all the budget problems, that there's going to be a lot of interest or ability for legislation to be enacted to throw more incentives. But I think if incentives are being considered, they should be really well thought out. Is the incentive really needed? Is it needed by everyone? Should it be a loan rather than a grant? Is there a fundamental purpose for the incentive? And should incentives target more efficient electric vehicles rather than provide incentives for Hummer-like EVs that travel less on a kilowatt hour than other vehicles? And it's been found that non-financial incentives can work as well and be attractive to consumers. Little perks like preferred parking, fancy-schmancy license plates, access to HOV lanes, anything that can make people feel really good about their new fancy green car. The issue of expanding infrastructure, EV charging, is very important. It's probably the section that has the most interesting and near-term policy ideas. Some important ideas in this category are getting utilities to do infrastructure planning and analysis as part of a regulatory proceeding. And this proceeding can be very broad so that we in the environmental and energy communities can learn a lot about what it means for EVs to enter into our states. Streaming an EV purchase, meaning getting making sure that the consumer has the ability to get a fast charging station installed at their home or apartment building is important. The automakers are keenly concerned that the consumer doesn't have to jump through a bunch of local or state regulatory hoops or zoning laws to get their infrastructure installed quickly. We think that municipal energy or property assessed clean energy programs should allow for level two charging systems to qualify for property tax repayment schemes. I'm trying to move along a little quickly here. And building codes might should be designed to make sure they're EV charging ready or renewable energy ready to facilitate charging vehicles with renewable energy. I'm going to move to manufacturing. I don't think there's too much here. You can look to the Michigan example as in terms of what they've done. Some groups have suggested that gas taxes be increased to pay for incentives for EV and battery manufacturing. That could be done at the state or federal level. Some have suggested a cash for EVs or a cash for conversions program modeled on the cash for clunkers program. And I think REAMP groups could easily lend themselves to, if there's anything going on at the federal level to help the industry, REAMP groups could certainly lend their support for that. So the recommendations we made were 8 points. The first is to create an electric vehicle readiness ad hoc group within REAMP, probably under the transportation working group area, and to kind of map out and coordinate amongst the states on what everybody's doing and to make sure the right policies are being adopted region-wide. The second thing is that we suggest that this regulatory proceeding, this infrastructure planning for utilities be adopted, and I can tell you that I have working with lawmakers in Minnesota, and a bill will come out shortly, a draft that will do just that. This was modeled on some provisions that were in the Waxman-Markey climate change bill that could pass the House of Representatives at the federal level, but we're moving it ahead in Minnesota. And I think it has the support of utilities. And the third area is this performance standard for new construction to be EV-ready. I already talked about that. And then the fourth is to allow municipal energy financing programs to cover the charging systems. And then the fifth point is to initiate government fleet conversions to EVs. We're strongly supportive of the public sector leading by example, and having EVs in public fleets can enhance consumer understanding and can allow for an easy-to-monitor group of vehicles that we can all learn from. And the sixth is to begin smart grid deployments, or at least have a formal setting where utilities are explaining their smart grid expansion plans and examining the relationship to electric vehicles. And then the seventh point is to fast track or simplify the permitting and installation of charging systems, which I've already talked about. And the final thing was to allow utilities cost recovery for any improvements they need to do on their electric distribution system to facilitate electric vehicles in neighborhoods. And with that, I'm going to stop talking because I prefer to just have questions and interaction with you guys. So there you have it.
Great. Thank you, John. We do have a couple questions that have come in through the chat. I'll start with Nancy Lang. Which Minnesota muni is encouraging wind storage in vehicles?
It's the Great River Energy utility.
Cool. And is that the same as the next question is what Minnesota G&T connects EV to wind generation?
Yeah, it's the same.
Okay. Excellent. And then the next question, and you can read this in the chat box that you have, but what are the load impacts, both in peak demand and total kilowatt-hour sales, of the kind of ramp-up of PEVs on electric system loads? Maybe pick a couple of years, 2015, 2020, 2030. Just a percentage of load would be helpful.
Oh, Dan. Okay, well, maybe I can answer it this way. Like a plug-in vehicle like the Chevy Volt coming out of the 40-mile electric range is going to be requiring about 2,500 kilowatt hours a year in electricity. There have been many studies that have been done that says our existing electricity capacity can facilitate tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, or not hundreds of millions, but many tens of millions of vehicles using the existing power plant system. And so depending on when these vehicles are being charged would depend on what the load impacts would be. I hope that maybe answers what you're getting to, Dan.
And once again, if you'd like to join in and on the voice side, anyone can dial *7. And we're gonna jump in.
John, Chuck Leshefsky from Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I apologize, I came in about 15 minutes late, but the part that I don't understand, and you kind of discuss it just in passing, and that's this idea of storing power and helping the utilities by giving it back to them when they need it. But if I understand that, usually that means that they would need it in, you know, the middle of the day on a hot July day, and most people would not either be in a place to give it up because they're at work, or they don't want to give it up because they still got to go home. How would that actually work?
Right. I mean, I didn't discuss the vehicle-to-grid issue all that much. We do have a longer discussion in the report itself, but there is this idea out there for those who don't understand what the question means, is that you could charge your car up at night, and a smarter grid would allow the utilities to have control over when that vehicle is charged, but also have control over drawing energy out of the vehicle during peak times of electricity need, say on a hot summer day when all the air conditioners are going. And as Chuck points out, it's for me, we conclude that it's a worthy thing to be looking at. It seems to be, if not a decade off, close to that in terms of being widely used. Obviously, it requires, I look out at my parking lot at my building, and it would require an enormous amount of charging infrastructure to be installed just in this one parking lot to facilitate an EV that wanted to be supplying power to the grid. New Jersey has already moved on, or I'm sorry, Delaware has already moved on legislation or in policy to allow vehicles to qualify for net metering. And there's just a whole host of things that need to be studied and worked out related to this concept that we didn't discuss it all that much in this report.
Great. And our next question, how can municipalities leverage EECBG grant programs with smart grid EV infrastructure?
This is the Energy Efficiency Community Block Grant Program. I haven't been following that federal money all that closely. I know that that cities can propose such programs, but I haven't been tracking that. Sorry, Hal.
And the next question from Kate Colouri. My understanding is that utilities make money off capital expenditures. If then, it would seem that upgrading their IT systems would be a moneymaker for them. Why then do you think they need cost reimbursement for IT upgrades?
I wasn't suggesting they needed cost recovery for IT upgrades. I was suggesting that if there are three vehicles in a certain neighborhood that requires a substation to be upgraded with, I don't know, something, that I'm suggesting that the utilities be allowed cost recovery for those investments. Their investments in smart grid technologies or IT systems, those are investments that would also qualify for rate recovery in their rate cases as well. So I assume that they would be given that by any utility commission.
Cool. And the next question from Eric Sundquist. How critical is level 2 charging? One of GM's boasts about the Volt is that it can be plugged into a standard plug. That would drastically cut infrastructure costs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in looking at charging, I do think level 2 charging will become very important as more and more vehicles enter the marketplace. What a standard plug does is let you charge your car completely overnight during all those hours. Well, that's fine, but when you are talking about a situation in the future where there are a lot of these vehicles in a certain area and possibly putting strain on the grid, the utilities are going to want to have a little bit more control over when your vehicles are charging. And so if level 2 charging gives you a 3-hour charge, you can see that overnight you could have the utility controlling the little neighborhood in a way that optimizes the charging to not adversely impact the grid. So I do, and I think consumers are going to want the ability to have a faster charging option, but I can't be sure about that. Consumers are consumers.
Great. And the next question from Monica Patel. How much would EV charging at night increase demand enough to increase off-peak rates?
It's a good question. Obviously, it depends on the pure number of vehicles. And I think it's one of these questions. This is a perfect question for this regulatory proceeding idea that we're advocating to answer. And I think in terms of off-peak rates, that's an interesting question, too, because in California, some utilities already have EV charging rates available to their customers. And for Southern California Edison, for example, it's 5 cents per kilowatt hour off-peak and about 29 cents per kilowatt hour on-peak. And frankly, I have a hard time believing even at 29 cents a kilowatt hour that it's going to necessarily drive people to charge off-peak. So I think that's a question I'd like to see answered in more detail about what consumers might be willing to pay, because even at 29 cents a kilowatt hour, it's still cheaper than gas. And so I think in the future we might see on-peak charging rates for vehicles that are, if we want people to move to off-peak, that are quite higher than that.
And a follow-up from Monica. In your research in Midwest states, did you come across potential areas for collaborative synergies? Are there obvious partnerships REAMP organizations can form to implement some of the low-hanging policy options?
Yes. I think in the REAMP network, there are a number of organizations in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, Illinois, and Ohio that are doing at least a little bit of work on electric vehicle policy this year. And I think there's certainly a lot of collaborative potential. What I've, in talking to the groups, it's seldom that any of the groups have any substantial financial resources to put towards staffing or efforts, but it's possible that, you know, we got this report funded out of a REAMP grant, and maybe REAMP would consider a future collaborative proposal amongst the states on electric vehicle work. And there may be other foundations out there that would be interested in helping that effort. I think if we can demonstrate that there's a serious need to ensure that our future EV fleets are as green as possible, that there are some foundations out there that could be interested in this. And I think if people want to kind of get networked with the groups that are kind of working on this stuff, I will try to coordinate that. So just drop me a note or give me a call, and we'll kind of get this little ad hoc group started and underway.
Great.
Hi, John. It's Christopher Childs, MRES and Sierra Club.
Hey.
Two quick questions, or one's quick anyway. I want to check my math. You said 500 turbines would power a million EVs, and my arithmetic makes that a kilowatt per EV. And I assume you were trying to work with real world numbers as opposed to just nameplate stuff?
Yes. I mean, there's a table in the report. Maybe the turbine size is a bit smaller. I'm at about a 2.5-megawatt turbine.
Okay. Somewhat connected to that, from MRES point of view, because we promote solar so much, we're hugely interested in the connection between home and business solar and EVs and PHEVs. And I'm wondering whether the transformation really that's underway thanks to thin film solar factored into your work on this. I know that Black and Veatch just basically threw out their old report on how much solar would be available in California by 2020. They're now saying they went from predicting 2,000 gigawatt hours per year to 40,000 gigawatt hours per year, which is two-thirds of California's projected demand. Obviously, we don't have the solar resource here that they have in California, but we still have a pretty good one, as witnessed by my house and the amount of power we produce.
Sure.
I just wondered if that was factored in at all to what you've reported here.
Yeah, I mean, we did have a little section on PVs. I wanted so badly. I'm a big fan of solar, and I'd love to see more solar going into vehicles. The economics, just as we laid out, it's a stretch right now. Obviously, the technology improves. We can maybe tell a different story. What I thought was interesting is that the kind of the on-peak rates that you see out in California for EV charging match up fairly well with solar, you know, including incentives and whatnot. And so there may be a role in the future. I don't think it's kind of prime time right now, but, you know, look, we got several years before these vehicles reach any even remotely level of penetration in the marketplace. So we have time to for economics to improve and to kind of study it a bit more.
Cool. And with that, it doesn't seem like there are any other questions, unless any other chats come through last minute.
Is Monica's potential areas for collaborations, what is that still the last question?
Yes, that was a note on her previous question.
Okay.
So with that, I think we can wrap up. John, if you have any other comments, or I would just like to thank you for taking the time to present this report and for everyone joining us today. This webinar was recorded, and for REAMP members, it'll be posted to the Commons at reamp.org/briefing. And just stay tuned to the Commons listservs for future webinars. So thanks again, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. See you, Eric.
Yeah, thank you, John. Bye-bye.